You're listening to Innovation for Alpha, where we explore everything at the intersection of healthcare innovation and finance. Through our discussions and interviews, we keep you informed and educated about healthcare innovations, next-level venture investing, and everything involving the combination of the two.
Hi, everybody. This is Tobin Arthur, your host for Innovation for Alpha, and I am joined today by a very special guest, Dr. Jaffer Raza, who is a interventional cardiologist based back on the East Coast. And Dr. Raza, great to have you here. Really nice to have you spend some time on the weekend with me.
Thank you, Tobin. I'm really excited about this podcast. I think we're going to have some fun chatting about some interesting things that has happened before and what's going to happen in the future.
Great. I agree. And I always enjoy chatting with you, but for those who don't know you, I want to give you a chance. Just talk a little bit about your background, where you trained and how you got into cardiology, a little bit about your pathway.
So I'm originally from India. I'm from South India in a very small village called Kailpatnam. It's very close to the southern tip of India. Grew up in a small town, went to medical school for the first time in a big city called Chennai, which used to be called Madras before. I went to Stanley Medical College there, part of University of Madras. And from there, life took a different turn for me. While I was in college, I was the only only person in my family who went into medicine. Everybody else is in business. And my family business was in Sri Lanka and Hong Kong. They were doing gemstones. So kind of when I went for my vacation to visit my family, I kind of got excited about business. It's interesting. I thought, I'm going to do some business and see if I like it. Maybe that's where my future is. I'm a doctor, but I could be a doctor businessman. So I was one of the earliest people in 1993 to go to China to start doing business with one of my friends, exporting electronics to all over the country. But at the same time, I never left my medicine go away. I still kept in touch with my medical part of things. I used to take care of people there. And the concept of taking USMLE came up because a lot of my friends went to England and some of them came to America, and I was like, I was not so keen on going to England. I thought it was a very cold, wet place. And then you see all these Hollywood movies with beautiful beaches in America. I said, I want to go to America. So yeah. I took my USMLE exams, and I said, okay, if I get into residency, I'm going to go do residency. If not, I'm doing business well, I'm going to continue with my business. Well, so to make long story short, I got accepted into a residency program in the U.S., came here. The reason why I chose to come to the Northeast was because I had a very distant relative who was a practicing cardiologist in Binghamton, New York. Mm. I said that my parents were like, you're going so far away, at least be close to somebody somebody we know. I didn't know that Binghamton would be that cold.
No beaches.
No beaches. It was like so close to, Buffalo, which means it's like really cold.
Yeah.
And for some reason, Binghamton's supposed to have the lowest number of sunny days in the whole country.
Perfect.
I come from the sunny South India to this cold, dark Binghamton. I survived Binghamton, and then when I came to this country, there is a way to come called a J-1 visa. Most of the doctors know about it. It's a exchange sponsor visas, which means that you have to go back to your country for 2 years at least before you come back to the U.S. Or you can work in an underserved area in the United States and then continue to stay in this thing. So I went to North Carolina, at least was much more sunny, close to the Outer Banks.
Yeah.
So I did my so-called J-1 waiver in Greenville, North Carolina. Mm. That's where I lived, but the waiver area was Wilson, North Carolina, which is the tobacco capital of the world. So all the tobacco auctions used to take place in Wilson. The reason why I took cardiology was, you know, as some people make joke, you know, a cardiologist are frustrated surgeons. You know, because the surgeons like to use their hands, and the guys who could not get into surgery, they go into cardiology, and especially interventional cardiology, because we use a lot of our hands.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in India, after I finished my medical college, for my internship, I worked in the plastic surgery department of my college. And my plastic surgery department was at that time considered the top plastic surgery department in the entire Asia.
Hmm.
And, we used to get a lot of accidents, patients with them. And we were extremely good at hand surgery. Hmm. So that's where we were famous for hand surgery.
Interesting.
You know, people who have gone to India, you know, one of the drinks that are sold in the streets are sugarcane drinks.
Okay.
So there's this big machine that's wheels around, and the guy feeds the sugarcane through that, and then, you know, the wheels it and squeezes out the juice.
Mm-hmm.
But they're so busy or what, sometimes they let their fingers go through the wheel. And next thing you know, the whole fingers are shattered and ripped off.
Oh, man.
So we used to take care of these patients. So we used to see one or two a day with this kind of sugarcane injury, especially in the summer months.
What do you do case, by the way? Generally speaking, what's the outcome?
We did very well because we were able to repair their tendons.
Okay.
Most of the time, the tendons were the ones that were cut off. So we used to do everything under, you know, like we didn't have sophisticated things as they have it in the United States. So every patient was like an outpatient. They come, we do an axillary block. We didn't give any general anesthesia to these people. We did an axillary block. We repaired these tendons. We repaired the skin. Sometimes we had to take skin grafts. So we used to take skin grafts from either from their shoulders or from their thighs and put it on them, patch them up, and then send them home.
Wow.
They may reway and they come back for a follow-up in the outpatient center.
Incredible.
So, it was like fascinating what we could do with the very little resources we had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, things have changed. This is, I'm talking about 93, it's 30 years ago. You know, things have changed a lot. But we were able to do amazing things. And the surgeon who I used to work with, he used to tell me, you should become a surgeon. You have good hands. I could not continue to do that because when I came to this country as a foreign graduate, getting into resident again, you know, it's all you're hearing from people. Getting into surgical residency is extremely tough for a foreign graduate. So you better go into medicine.
Mm.
So, while you're doing residency, also you see that the group of doctors that were respected a lot among the residents and the interns were the interventional cardiologists, you know, because, you know, we see this macho man coming in, you know, the guy's coming with a heart attack to the emergency room. He thinks he's dying. He takes him to the cath lab, you know, 20 minutes later, he comes out and says that we saved his life. He's good. So there was some instant gratification there.
Sure.
You know? And I don't think there's any field in medicine or surgery that has as much impact on somebody's life as interventional cardiologists do,
mm-hmm.
you know, which is very true because, you know, minutes make a difference.
Right.
Seconds make a difference. You know, somebody is having massive heart attack that, you know, the widowmaker artery is closed or whatever it is. And we take them to the cath lab, you know, the guy thinks he is dying. And 5 minutes later, after I opened up his artery, he's like, "Doc, when can I go home?" You know, jeez. you could never forget that feeling when you hear that from the patients.
Mm.
But at the same time, it's also very humbling because there are times when there are young people who come and we couldn't save them. And I had to come out and talk to their children, their mother, parents, wife, saying that, I'm sorry, I couldn't save your husband or your father, your son, whatever it is. And it makes you very humbling.
By the way, on that point real quick, we just were talking with a family the other day, and they were talking about one of their brothers had passed away. He was in his mid-30s, had young kids, but died of a heart attack. How often does that happen anymore? Because is that common or uncommon?
You know, heart attack at young age is not very common. You know, okay. I think, you know, it kind of gets the attention of a lot of the people because it's really, you know, shakes people up when you hear that a 32-year-old, 33-year-old guy died of a heart attack. I have my one personal example of a patient like that. You know, when I was doing my fellowship, there was this guy who used to play for the local college football player. Mm. He finished playing, and then, you know, after that, he went into was working as a prison officer or something like that.
Okay.
And so well built, you know, like you imagine a good football player. So he was brought to the hospital, and saying having chest pain. He was 32 something, exactly around the same age, 32, 33. And I go see him in the emergency room, and he's holding his chest and chest pain. His daughter, this is what had, I can still forget this case because his daughter was 8 or 9 years old, standing there, you know, for her father is like this macho man, you know, nothing can affect him. He's the strong guy. He's a football player. And she was like, look, my dad is having chest pain. He's complaining of chest pain. By the time we rolled him from the emergency room to the cath lab, he coded.
Wow.
His heart stopped. So we immediately got him on the table, went up with the catheter. Like, we had no pulse. We were lucky to get into his artery. When we took the first picture, the left main coronary artery, which is the artery on the left side that branches into other branches, that artery was closed.
Wow.
And, you know, in spite of all the things that we did, we couldn't save him.
Mm. Mm.
So that's what when I meant by saying that, you know, minutes, seconds can make a difference here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and he had so much thrombus. His arteries are big arteries. There's so much thrombus. It doesn't matter whatever machine we used to suck out the clot, he was continuously, you know, going down and down and down.
Mm-hmm.
And was very sad. And, you know, they were like, and he was well known among the community. So there was a lot of people, like 30, 40 people showed up in the hospital.
Oh, wow.
To go and tell them that this 32-year-old died was, at that time, I didn't have to talk. My attending was the one who was doing the talking.
Oh, jeez.
I was standing with him, and was not an easy conversation to have.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Wow. One other thing I want to touch on, you mentioned, so having grown up in India, for those not familiar, my understanding is it's very competitive and difficult to, you know, getting to university, medical school in particular. Talk a little bit about that's not insignificant to get to.
You know, it's just the sheer number of people. You know, India has 1.2, 1.3 billion people. So, you know, when I took, in India, you go from 12th grade to medical college. You don't go to undergrad to go. So the 12th exam really makes a difference, how much mark you score. And, you know, and there's also something called an entrance exam. So the combination of your scores from the 12th standard and the combination and the score from your entrance exam makes a difference. And this is make or break, you know, at 17 year old. This is a huge burden, you know, something similar to what happens in South Korea. You know, South Korea, this exam is supposed to be you hear a lot of suicide because the kids did not score the marks they wanted to score. And similar things happens in India too, the suicide among people. So you're competing against, like, because of the sheer volume, you're competing, like, for example, the 12th grade, there is like 2 million kids in my state alone writing the exam.
Jeez.
And the number of medical seats are probably, you know, I would say, especially when I was going, there were not many private medical colleges. So literally like 8 medical colleges. So, you know, each one has about 150 seats.
Wow.
So you just calculate about 1,000 seats, you're competing like 2 million kids writing the exam. And for Indian dad or Indian parents, you have to be a doctor. That's the only thing.
Just a little bit of pressure.
Yeah.
Wow.
So just a lot of pressure. And, you know, thanks to God, you know, I was one of the bright kids in my school. And, you know, I was the first in my school in the 10th standard exam, which is, and then again in the 12th standard exam.
That's pretty cool.
So, yeah, it was so, you know, I'll tell you something about why I became a doctor too. You know,
it's,
I did not want to be a doctor. You know, and my dad, it seems he wanted to be a doctor. And, but, you know, I was a good student and I got accepted to both medical college and engineering college. And at that time, the computers were coming up good. So I wanted to really go into this famous university called Anna University in Chennai, which is a very good engineering program.
Yep.
So I got into that. And the conversation with my dad was like, listen, I got into a very good in a university for computers, and maybe I would want to do that. And all along, I was thinking that I'm going to go into business. I can do engineering and go into business.
Yeah,
I might not be able to, go into medicine and go into business. You know, my dad played this game of like, you know, I really wanted to be a doctor, but I couldn't get into medical school. You got into medical school. You are the only child for me. Well, make my dreams come true. So the emotional pressure, I couldn't say no.
Oh, yeah. He loaded it on you.
Yes, yes. But I don't regret now, you know, now that what I have achieved, you know, sometimes as a 17-year-old again, what do you know?
Right. That's right.
Right. So yeah, I'm glad I listened to my dad. Yeah.
Well, and you had a chance recently to go back and visit, which, you know, was difficult during COVID. So you probably hadn't been back there for a while. Have things changed? How was travel? You know, what was that experience like just getting to get on the plane and go?
I mean, yeah, it was used to be like you get on the plane and you went, you know, now, you know, especially there's not many direct flights from here to India. So you had to go through either Europe or Middle East. And, you know, so the restrictions are a lot, quite a bit, you know, you have to make sure that you had your COVID testing within 48 hours of traveling. And it happened to my cousin. He was supposed to come at the same time. And you had different kind of COVID testing. I got the right one. He didn't get the right one. So he couldn't board the plane.
Oh, geez.
So he was left behind for two more days to get his test and everything organized. And India has done a very good job with screening. And, you know, and as soon as you land there, you know, especially if you're coming from a high-risk country, they're testing you again. You cannot leave the airport without being tested again.
Wow.
Making sure that you're negative. U.S. is not one of the countries, so I was lucky that I didn't have to go through that. But if you're coming from Europe, quite a bit of the countries, especially when I went, was the Omicron was going on.
Oh, yeah.
So they had to, all, a lot of the people had to test and go back. And same thing coming back again, you had to have all these testing and everything done. In India, Indian people are very resilient people. You know, like as I told you, it's because of the sheer volume, it's all about, you know, survival of the fittest.
Yep.
So, you know, whether it's education, whether it's business, whether it's, you know, just about anything, even walking on the street, you got to find your ways to go through and walk along the street. Because if you walk on the streets of Chennai, it's crowded. It's not like, you know, Fifth Avenue is nothing compared to the street in Chennai.
Wow.
So, you know, when I took my wife, you know, she's not Indian. When I took her for the first time, she was a well-traveled person. She had traveled to, her father worked for the United Nations. So she had traveled quite a bit with him, different countries. And she said that nothing prepared her for a visit to India.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
Whether it's the smell or the sounds or the, you know, or the colors or the, you know, the, just about, she said, nothing prepared me. And the dichotomy between the rich and the poor, you know, you are staying in a 5-star hotel with all the amenities, the best of any world can offer. When you open your window, you right below you, you see a slum where a little kid trying to take a food out of a garbage.
Wow.
So those kind of things, it just, it really, really touches you more.
Yeah. That's incredible. Let's fast forward, come to the present day. You ended up in New York and New Jersey. Talk a little bit about, you know, your practice and kind of your focus over the last couple of years.
Let me go back a little bit, a few years after my training. Because when I was working as to get my J-1 waiver in North Carolina, that's when, you know, I had to do all the publications and everything to prepare myself as an applicant for cardiology. So I eventually got accepted into East Carolina University for cardiology. I did my general cardiology there. But I knew I always wanted to be an interventional cardiologist. So I was looking at different places where to go. I had a choice to stay there if I wanted to. But my wife is from New Jersey, you know, and she said, "Look, why don't you just try the city a little bit more for me? It's 1 year. What's big deal? Go, you train and you come back." So I visited different hospitals. And then the hospital I liked the most where I wanted to train was in Lenox Hill Hospital. And they were amazing, amazing teachers there. You know, Dr. Gary Rubin, who invented the first coronary stent, you know, he was there. Dr. Howard Cohen, Dr. Kirk Garrett, Dr. Jerry Vitek, you know, Dr. Vitek, Dr. Rubin, and Sri Iyer were the trinity of the carotid interventions. They did almost every single study that's needed for carotid interventions, you know. The catheters named after them, the products they have after them, and things like that. So when I had this kind of amazing teachers, that was my choice to go. I know. Mm-hmm. And I did my training there. It was unbelievable experience learning from these gurus in cardiology, interventional cardiology. Mm. And then, you know, my plan was again to go back to the South. I didn't want to stay in the Northeast because it's too cold for an Indian. I had a very fantastic opportunity in West Virginia. And I was walking last month of my training. I was in the cath lab and Dr. Rubin comes and asks me, "Jeff," he used to call me Jeff, "Jeff, what are you doing next year, coming next month?" "Well, I got a fantastic opportunity in this place. I'm going to go there and start there." It's like, "What do you mean you're going there? You're my star fellow. I want you here." You know, when that happened, you know, obviously I couldn't say no to my teacher and my mentor. So I stayed at Lenox Hill as a faculty, grew up to be the associate director of the cath lab there. Mm. And then, you know, as everything happens, you know, people transition of team, transition of and the attendings, retirement, and all these kind of things. I had this opportunity to move to New Jersey to start cardiology for a multi-specialty group in 2016. So I came here, started the cardiology group for this huge multi-specialty group with 250 physicians at that time when I came. And we have grown year over year in the COVID. Nothing has stopped us year over year. We are growing 20-25%. Wow. And has been a great ride so far.
Where's that group in terms of locations? Are they exclusively in New Jersey or are they spread out a little bit?
So this group was started by a pediatrician 40 years ago. And oh, wow. Then, you know, he grew it into this huge group with multi-specialty physicians. Started in the Bergen County in New Jersey. So the predominantly most of the practice is in northern New Jersey. Okay. But about a few years ago, this group was acquired by Optum.
Oh, okay.
So now it's part of the Optum Tri-State, which is so we are expanding all over the state, and we have our sister organizations in New York and Connecticut also.
Oh, wow. So has that been an adjustment, having a big parent group like that?
It's definitely an adjustment. It's definitely an adjustment. You know, before this, it was more like a family-run corporation. It was decisions were made right here in New Jersey. Now there are definitely several layers of decision makers who we have to go through to get anything done. But there are also tremendous advantages too. You know?
Sure.
Now I'm able to relate to my CDOs from all over the country. You know, Optum practices are in Texas, in Florida, in California, in Washington. And we are all, some of us are in different panels and different committees. Like I'm in the cardiology committee for the Optum. So we have this way to interact with people, exchange ideas, exchange practice patterns from all across the country. So we all learn from each other.
That's kind of neat.
So there's advantages and disadvantages just with about anything.
Sure.
And,
yeah.
Being an optimist myself, I just always look at the positive things.
I like that. Well, and you, we talked about your business acumen and interests early on, and that's never really left, I suspect. Talk a little bit about, you know, some of your, not necessarily side projects, but just your interest. You know, we talked a little bit earlier about just this notion of home healthcare is going to continue to grow, and there's so much opportunity there. But just, you know, and aside from your day-to-day clinical work, what are some of the things that you have thought about or maybe even, you know, played around with over time?
You know, I always want to do things new. You know, it excites me just about anywhere I have gone. I have always tried to see what is the next thing we can do. And never, maybe it's my personality. I'm never content with what is status quo. So I always try to do things. You know, way back about 15 years ago, when nobody was talking about remote monitoring or anything like that, you know, a friend of mine who's an engineering background, you know, like at that time I went and spoke to him. I said that, listen, the one of the highest visits to emergency room is for chest pain, you know, and several billions of dollars are being spent on ER visits for chest pains. And less than 5% of the patients who end up going to the ER end up needing admission or has some kind of coronary syndrome. So 95% of the people don't need to go to the emergency room. So if we can keep these people out of the emergency room, the amount of saving to the government of the healthcare expenses is significant. So we did come up with a way of monitoring people's EKG. You know, we came up with a special way of how the patient, you know, even somebody who's uneducated can put a leads on themselves, and the lead will be transmitted through their phones to the doctor or the call center, the center which is monitoring them. And we can give an instruction to the patient, yes, you need to go to the hospital, or no, you don't need to go to the hospital. And we even had a way of communicating that patient's information to a doctor's office who they were related to, or and so that the doctor's office will have make an appointment for them to see them the next day. Long story short, you know, it's not many people. Well, we couldn't. I wish we had some kind of angel MD at that time. We didn't have enough funding for that. And because of that, you know, we could not proceed further. And my friend was also very, did not want to exchange ideas with a lot of people. So that kind of eventually didn't come through. And like now you see all these big companies, whether it's Apple or, you know, all these companies doing this thing, which I wanted to do 12 years ago. Maybe I was ahead of the game, but didn't know how to finish it.
Right. Well, speaking of Apple, so they did their quarterly earnings call this last week, and Tim Cook was talking about the Apple Watch, and they've got a new generation coming up. But of course, one of the big things in the Apple Watch has been the heart monitoring. And excuse me, anecdotally, he was talking about the benefits and how the watch had instructed, you know, I don't know how many numbers of people, but people that had some concerns to go to the hospital, and it had saved lives. The article I was reading said, you know, en masse, it hasn't had a huge impact, but there are some anecdotal instances where it's had some benefits. You know, as a cardiologist, what's your perspective on things like the iWatch and the potential for that? Do you see Is it impacting at all yet, or is it still early, or how would you gauge that?
You know, I think technology is going to play a big role in healthcare in the future, whether it's not just EKG, whether it's, you know, there are companies coming with amazing technology where it can predict a fall risk on a patient. It can, you know, check their weight status, check their fluid status, you know, all this. So I think technology is going to play a huge role. It's the way how we are going to use it is what is going to matter the most.
Mm-hmm.
For every one patient or something like Apple Watch save their life, we get several number of abnormal readings, which is really not abnormal. You know, so it's and it's, it causes panic, it causes stress in people.
Mm.
You know, so like they're seeing this at, you know, 10 o'clock at night,
right.
And you know, they cannot come to a doctor's office to clarify things, then the whole night they're panicking.
Mm.
So there should be, like as you said, it's in early stages. I think the technology will get better and these things will be sorted out, or there'll be some way that, you know, somebody with knowledge can look at this thing and say that, hey, this is an artifact. It's not nothing to worry about as compared to this is a real problem. You need to get to the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big fan of technology. I think technology will play a big role in the future of medicine, but I think it's still too early for watches like this to make a diagnosis for a patient.
Yeah, it's good. It's fair. And we were talking earlier, you gave me some pretty incredible statistics, but talk about the cost that you know, a patient in the hospital versus being treated at home. There's a pretty big disparity there.
So this experience comes from being practicing in India for a few years before I came here. So when I first came to this country, and you know, obviously America is, you know, very well developed. We have so much resources, money is not a problem, things like that. When I was a resident or an intern walking around the hospitals, I used to think that this person will never be in a hospital in India.
Hmm.
You know, and majority of the people, like, you know, if the patient is in ICU in India, the patient is intubated or, you know, real major problems.
Mm-hmm.
Here, I walk to an ICU, a patient is sitting and talking to me. Right. And if a patient has, you know, certain infections, you know, you try to treat them as an outpatient. Now, granted, you know, America is a very, I don't know how to put it in the right words. It's, you know, there's a lot of lawsuits and things like that against the doctors. Sure. And a lot of defensive medicine is being practiced here.
Right.
But it's not the case. So in India, you know, doctors are treated as like gods there. When the doctor tells you something, patients take it right there.
Right. Here they argue with you because they searched on Google.
Right. Yeah. They come up with the, you know, they come up with a big list of answers, questions, and when you try to convince them, you said that's not what Google told us. So I said I didn't go to Google University; I went to Madras University.
All right.
So that, you know, that kind of always told me, like, you know, a lot of the patients. You know, again, if you look at the expenses of America, you know, the whole healthcare expenses, the doctor's fees, the doctor's payment is less than 7% of the entire expenses of the thing. The majority of the expenses goes to hospitals and drug companies and, you know, medications and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
So if we can keep these patients out of the hospital and still give them the best care, you know, nobody wants to be in a hospital. You know, if you feel better when you're at home,
right?
If you're able to take care of what your needs are in your home, in your comfortable environment, then that will make a huge difference. Mm. I'll give you an example about heart failure patients, right? You know, there is over $100 billion being spent in a management of heart failure patients.
With a B, 40,
50, B. Yes, with a B, exactly. You know, 50 to 55% of these expenses is for hospital care of these patients. hospital is not a safe place. You know, when these are sick patients, if they are coming to management of heart failure, they can end up getting an infection. They can end up getting some other things that they would never have got it if they were at their homes. So if we're able to monitor these patients, like, that's why I'm a big fan of all this remote monitoring and everything that's coming up. You know, we are able to monitor the patient's vital signs, the patient's fluid status, the patient's weight, the patient's blood pressure, the pulse oximeter, all these things. And if we can keep these patients out of the hospital and get them the treatment, you know, even having a nurse practitioner or a nurse visit these patients, do this care at home, even twice a day, it still will going to end up costing you much lower than what's going to cost to keep these patients in the hospital. And the patients are happy because they're at their home, not avoiding, avoiding getting any kind of infections and things like right. that.
Yep.
And I think that's going to be the future. Yeah. And the hospitals are also starting to understand that this is where the future is going to go. So many systems, even the insurance companies and the hospital systems, are trying to put together a team to take care of these patients with care coordination and give them the best care and keep them out of the hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And go ahead.
Oh, go ahead. I was just going to say, just to kind of bring it home and wrap up the conversation. And I think, you know, you exemplify the exact kind of physician that AngelMD was designed for, which is somebody who doesn't accept the status quo. They've got an entrepreneurial bent, and entrepreneurial not necessarily meaning they're going to create a business, although many do, but entrepreneurial in the sense that they're always looking for how do we make things better than they are today, either working with somebody else and supporting their thing. As you look forward the next couple of years, and you are in an interesting position now, you're in a large organization, you've got a very successful cath lab. What are the kinds of, you know, projects or things that keep you stimulated that you're thinking about outside of, you know, your day-to-day clinical work, which of course keeps you very busy, but in those extra hours, you know, what are you thinking about in terms of the future?
It's a big question to answer.
That was an unfair question because it is too broad. I didn't mean to say, you know, in terms of career, but, you know, what kinds of things interest you sort of on a micro level in terms of technologies or terms of trends or things that you're, you know, kind of passionate about maybe clinically and seeing where they go?
You know, I'm a doctor first, so I believe in giving the best care to my patients. You know, when a patient walks to my office, I want to make sure that I am present there, listening to the patient, giving them the best care, making sure that I give them the options of what are the different kind of treatments needs to be done, and why I think one is better than the other. You know, and I always tell them, but eventually it's you who have to make the decision. I can give you a guidance based on my education, but it's you. Your body, you make the decision what you want to do. Obviously, I'm not going to let them make a bad or a wrong decision that's going to hurt them. But when there are options to do different things, I always tell them that thing. And the other thing that I'm thinking about a lot is like the expenses of healthcare is not sustainable. You know, but at the same time, innovations needs expenses. So it's kind of a conflict. Like, you know, new treatments are more expensive. Sure. The new treatments are needed. But at the same time, the amount of money being spent on healthcare is not sustainable. So I'm constantly working with people to say, okay, certain things needs to be done, even if it's expensive, because the quality, it's giving quality of life to the patient, it's prolonging their life of the patients and things like that. But then there are things that which we can do, for example, as we talked about, you know, we can take care of heart failure patients at home. Mm-hmm. You know, we can reduce the cost by 50-60%. So that money we are saving, we can put into the innovation.
Right. Well, and you're also saving money, but there's no degradation. In fact, it might even be better care. So you're not having to diminish care.
Absolutely. So we are not diminishing the quality of the care. We're still giving them the care, maybe even a better care, because as I said, we keep them at home. you know, which the patients like. And the money we are saving, we can spend in the new innovations, the new technology, the new, you know, we're talking about doing robotic CADs, you know, we're talking about preventing problems for the doctors by using radiation safety and all these things in the cath lab. And similar thing is happening across different specialties. You know, cross, you know, with the 5G, we're talking about doing transcontinental surgeries.
Right.
Right. So I think there's, it's an exciting time to be in healthcare. Mm-hmm. I think the technology and the knowledge of the doctors, the medical skills, the clinical skills are, you know, kind of coming together. I think the future is very good for anybody who's wanting to be a doctor or in, being in biotechnology. And that's where I keep telling my children, you know, my I have a 15-year-old and a 13-year-old, two boys. And that's our dinner table conversations, you know, like, and good, they engage me and they ask me smart questions. And I tell them, these are the different options you have. Like, I didn't have this option growing up in a small village in India. I mean, nobody told me that what to expect or what not to expect, you know, when I came. So I had to swim by myself. But I'm happy that I'm in this country where advancement always happens, where the technology is always the first place to come to. And I'm able to give this guidance to my kids. And I do that to all my residents and the trainees and the students who come across, who I come across, who come to my office or in the hospital where I teach and things like that.
Well, given the opportunities you had and you went to medical school, you don't have to give the same talk to your boys that your dad did to you. Sort of laying it on them.
So I, you know, at least now I set by example, you know, they watch me what I do and they can choose whether they want to do it or not.
That's right.
Yeah.
Do so I like what dad does or do I not like what dad does?
Right. Exactly. They don't like the long hours.
Right. Yeah.
You know, but they've, you know, I, one of the, I think last year or the year before, no, before COVID, when they, you know, take your kid to the work day. Mm-hmm. I took my son to the hospital and he saw me doing catheterization and things like that. And he was super excited about it.
That's cool.
And it looks like he went and told all his friends that I got to see these cool things.
Yeah. That's pretty neat.
Yeah.
Well, Dr. Raza, thanks for spending time on the weekend. You're with family, and so I really appreciate your time getting away. It's been great to chat and talk about a little bit of your life and some of your perspectives. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, Tobin, for including me in this your podcast. And, you know, and what AngelMD is doing is amazing. I think you're giving a platform for the doctors who have this skills or the ideas but not able to take it to the next step, and at the same time you're also able to identify the companies which are, like, I'm able to see companies which are early stages but coming up with amazing technology, and I'm fortunate to be part of this organization.
Well, thank you
for having me.
I appreciate it.
Take care.
See you again soon for the next episode of Innovation for Alpha. Make sure to go to Innovation for Alpha for access to prior episode links, show notes, and other valuable resources. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any investment decisions, please consult with a professional. This show is copyrighted by AngelMD Media, and written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.